My name's Ian Davis. I'm a writer and a blogger. I write a blog called In This Together. My background is in health and social care. So I worked for more than 30 years in mainly with in substance misuse and with people with mental health needs. I was a drug and alcohol counsellor for most of my working life. I got made redundant about 2 years ago. As you were prone to do in that world, because often in drug and alcohol counselling, it's about the contracts and whether your company's going to win the next contract. But I was made redundant. Actually, at the time, I was working for the local authority, and I'd always been interested in this kind of looking at this kind of information and looking at I've always been interested in history and politics and political history.
Okay, well, before we go into your blog, can you just tell us briefly, as someone that's broadly worked in health, what you make of the pandemic, plandemic? What do you make of the whole COVID thing over the last year, 18 months?
Well, I mean, I think it's I think you said it there. Plandemic is probably the right way of thinking about it. I mean, my personal view is that I don't think that COVID is a hoax or anything like that. I think that quite clearly there is a disease, a respiratory illness which affects people. Sadly, people have died as a result, but I don't think it is on anything even remotely close to the scale that they are claiming. So, I mean, I don't think that the mortality figures, when you look at the mortality figures, they don't stand up to basic scrutiny. I mean, sort of a basic analysis of the figures that have been produced. It doesn't it, there's no basis for the claims that they're making. So, I think if you consider that this is probably a disease which is, and all the science would seem to indicate, and all the research that has been done thus far would seem to indicate that it is comparable in statistical terms to a bad influenza season.
Yeah, okay. So getting into the blog, it's I think fascinating. You decided to call it In This Together. Why is that?
Well, I don't know if you remember, but when I started the blog, David Cameron was going around the country saying that we were all in this together. And the first thing I noticed about him saying that is that we certainly were not all in this together. I think.
Yeah, this was a phrase which was used after the 2008 financial crisis, wasn't it? And the
Yes.
austerity measures and all this. So you've got massive cutbacks in government spending, and all sorts of services that we pay for through our taxes collapsing, those taxes being diverted to the banks, and interest payments and God knows what. So, the idea is there's been an enormous, it's like a kind of sluice gate changing its direction with the taxpayers' money going to banks rather than to public services. And we were supposed to be, everyone was suffering equally. Well, of course, they weren't.
No.
Yeah, you're quite right. But I mean, reason I am wanting to get you on was to talk, Ian, about this. You did an attempt to do a sort of timeline of the New World Order. Well, what would you say to people when we before we start that would say that, well, there is no such thing as a New World Order. This is just a term used by conspiracy theorists. That's at least the view of every single journalist in the mass media in this country.
I mean, in a sense, they're right. There isn't a thing that you would call that you could say that this is specifically the New World Order. The New World Order is a term that has been used for many years, for centuries, to describe an idea of global governance. So it's been used by journalists and politicians and diplomats and the people who behind the scenes that what you might call the movers and shakers, people like Henry Kissinger, for years and years to describe their idea of global governance. Now, it's also been a term that's been used in books, you know, famously H.G. Wells. More recently, president of the Council of Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, wrote World Order 2.0. So it is a term simply to express an idea, and that idea is global governance. So insofar as, I've heard people say that it's an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. So the idea being that, it fits in with some illusion or delusion about a Jewish conspiracy. There's nothing about the New World Order as it's been used in some of the speeches at the United Nations and places like that. When the European Union recently wrote a document about the European Union in the New World Order, which is a document that you can freely download, it's in the public domain. I can't remember who gave the speech. I think it might have been Mario Draghi. He wasn't talking about a Jewish conspiracy theory. He was talking about global governance, which is exactly how the term is used and has been used for decades, if not centuries.
Well, it sounds to me like you're saying the people announcing this idea of global governance, when they use the term New World Order, that's fine. But anybody that's critiquing it is smeared as an anti-Semite. I mean, this anti-Semitism smearing, I'm getting a little bit tired of it, particularly because I find it particularly despicable to be, dragging up any kind of, or basically trying to lump together anybody that's an investigative journalist, along with people who are trying to say that the Holocaust never happened, etc. This is an absolutely appalling, despicable misuse of language and a misuse of the Holocaust for your own political ends. But anyway, so how have you managed to track the beginning of this so-called New World Order then? Whereabouts do you think it started?
I think you can go back thousands of years. You can go back to the Phoenicians and the Venetians and, the idea, as long as there have been tyrants and as long as there have been kings, they have always dreamt of centralising their power and authority over as much of the earth as possible. So it goes that far. But in terms of modern history, it was Professor Carol Quigley who wrote his book in 1966, A Tragedy and Hope, A History of, the History of the World in Our Time.
Okay, well, just before we get to Quigley, the Phoenicians, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think they're a fascinating lot. They practiced human sacrifice. That's absolutely clear. Many of the countries where they established trade links, they use those trade links to basically bump off the priesthoods that weren't using human sacrifice. So they tried to spread that whole thing around the world as part of, this is the deal. If you want to have trade with the Phoenicians and through the Phoenicians, you also got to have human sacrifice in your societies. And they use this, of course, as a way of basically bumping off any of their opposition and trying to make out they were doing it for the gods or whatever. But the other key thing about the Phoenicians is they were involved in building Solomon's Temple way back in, at the beginning, once the Jews had established themselves in Jerusalem and built a temple to Yahweh, the Old Testament God. The Phoenicians were the ones that came along and built that temple for them on a model which had been used in the whole of the ancient world. So they were a very important priest class and a trading class. And I put it to you, this is one of the quite interesting things about, it's almost like a kind of hidden religion here we're dealing with that's based on money, based on trade and based on controlling trade. But it's a big leap to go back from 1500, 1300 BC right up to 1966. So can you just sort of give us a few stops in between times?
Yeah, I think if you go, as Quigley pointed out in his book, the modern way of creating this system of global governance has been achieved through infiltration, and particularly infiltration of the financial system. So if you can look at the Venetians from from Central Europe, then the start of the banking, international banking dynasties that grew up in the Mediterranean, in and around the Mediterranean, in shortly after the Knights Templar and that kind of that time, how that was financed, the conquests and so forth. That's when we start to see an organized international financial structure, and that was being led by then the Venetians, who were building city states and were basing their tentacles, if you like, their ability to control governments internationally through the finances. So, if you were a German king and you wanted to fight a war, you needed to finance that war, you needed to go to the Venetian bankers, and you needed to get your money to be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's just as an analogy here. I mean, you've got the king of wherever it's at. I mean, even in the UK, in England, the king, he needs to raise finance. So what he does is he farms out, basically gives a bit of power to a city state, like here in Bristol, for example. And he says to those merchants, you go and, basically run your own affairs, but I'm going to take a cut of everything you make. And so what he's doing is he's really letting them off the leash, and particularly with the, trade that they're able to establish through their shipping. He's saying, look, just go for it. Get as much as you can, acquire as much property, land, conquer places, etc., and get things going. And all the money you make, I will take a bit of it. And that's a kind of almost like a kind of franchise system. So, yep. But as a process, these merchants started getting very powerful and actually started looking back at the king and thinking, well, maybe we don't need this guy anymore. And so they established these networks around the world, which were almost like the earliest transnational corporations. I know you mentioned the Templars. There's a lot of people have suggested that they were the first international bankers. So they were the first companies that really were transnational. And of course, in those days, because they had the protection of the Pope, they were immune from local laws. So they couldn't be arrested in countries because they were so-called protected by the Pope. But how does Quigley explain, how that, changed over the years? I mean, the Templars were medieval. We're talking here about the periods after the Templars, maybe the 1400s, 1500s. How did we get to something which is maybe it's post medieval, or when we get to the period of, say, not quite the Renaissance, the Reformation and the English Civil War time?
Well, you've still got, it's the same mechanism, but it's changing all the time. It's being done through financial means. So it's when you get to what Quigley spoke about was how empire was an extension of basically rampant capitalism, but not in a free market sense. This is crony capitalism gone wild. So it's the establishment. Certainly, if you're talking about during the sort of 17th century, 18th century, wars of conquest, the reason for those wars of conquest was to develop markets. It was to create more markets and grab more resources to build a financial empire. So although it was being done by governments and it was being done by generals and kings and queens, it was being pushed and encouraged by financiers. So I think you said earlier, you were talking about, when did this transition happen? When did the financiers start looking at the kings and queens and thinking, hang on a minute, we don't need them? I would suggest that was the Venetians, that the Venetians realized that effectively they were in charge. But rather than stand there and have someone shoot arrows at them, they would rather that somebody else took the rap for it. And this is where you start seeing manipulation behind royalty, the manipulation behind the power establishment. So the people, and to this day, that leaves us now in a position today where we think we elect politicians to lead us, but they're not in charge. You know, they're not in charge of anything, really.
Well, I suppose the people in charge are the ones that dangle the politicians in front of us for us to vote for. But look, I know you wrote in your review about this, Who Are the New World Order, A Brief History. You wrote about this guy, Alfred Milner, who was working very closely with Cecil Rhodes. So I think he's somebody that doesn't get enough attention, as far as I can see. Rhodes was, he was operating in Africa mainly, but at the point where the British Empire was on the verge of sort of, they'd got ideas using the Royal Navy and all sorts of intimidation. They'd grabbed loads of territory and they were thinking, well, a few little, more decades and maybe we can get enough territory and enough power, enough resources to take over the world. They really did believe at the end of the 19th century that this was feasible for the British Empire to become, completely dominant around the world. And they'd actually made quite a lot of effort to do that, making inroads into China, using Hong Kong and Macau and places like that. Everywhere that was a big, powerful place had somewhere, which was the Royal Navy was using its power to project it into there. But anyway, can you just say a little bit about these characters? Because I find him absolutely fascinating, Rhodes, in that he actually did a secret will, didn't he, where he said, I want to create a secret society to bring about this global domination. And that is something which many people have pointed out is manifested itself in the United States in the Council of Foreign Relations, in London, in Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs. So this development at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, was quite important.
Yeah, I think it's important to bear in mind that it's very difficult to judge these people's morality from the perspective of today. But I mean, if we were in the cold, hard, sort of harsh light of day, we would say that Rhodes was a racist, eugenicist, generally unpleasant chap.
He'd probably say that everybody was in my day,
Yes, he would. He was an imperialist of the worst kind, if you think about put it that way. But as I said, it's difficult to judge these people from our modern moral perspective. One of the things that he thought was important about the British Empire, and this is the reason that I mentioned that, is because he thought it was a moral argument. He thought that empire was a moral virtue, because the best thing that could ever happen to anyone is that they would be invaded by the British. I mean, that's not dissimilar to what the Romans thought. The idea was that the British Empire was the pinnacle of all culture and all society. So the best thing that could be, I mean, forget about the Moors, forget about all the other cultures that had existed before that have invented things and been, arguably more influential on science and maths and all that kind of stuff. Forget about that. The British Empire was the greatest thing that had ever happened. So there was a moral imperative to go around the world and subdue it and make it into a model of the British Empire. But when Rhodes was advocating this, I think there had already started to be a realisation, certainly by people like Milner, that it was unlikely that this would be able to be done militarily. They were very upset about the loss of the American colony, the US colony, but they were seeing rising powers in Europe, certainly Germany, and they were aware of the growing economic and military power of the United States, and I think they accepted and understood that they weren't going to be able to do this by pure force of arms, that it would have to be done through political and economic means. And that is very much the basis of why Rhodes set up this, which he, something that he openly admitted was a secret society, to set up this Anglo-American establishment. Initially was the idea that they would unite the US and the UK, the Anglo-Saxon speaking world, as he saw it, would unite and form a global empire. And he, but they genuinely perceived that to be a moral virtue. It was a very convenient moral virtue because, of course, they would be the primary beneficiaries of it.
Yeah, and you say in 1902, 2 months after the death of Rhodes, this Pilgrim Society was formed. Now, this, you know, it sounds to me as if, I know this is, it'd be interesting to see what you make of this, but it was a transatlantic group, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Rhodes died in 1902, and the first, and he left several wills. I think the seventh will was probably the most famous because that created what we call the Rhodes Scholarships, which obviously is, you know, still running today, and it's a very prestigious scholarship to have. But the Pilgrim Society was created immediately. So the first thing that happened after he died, having set up this system of financing to create this one world system of global governance, was the creation of the Pilgrim Society. The Pilgrim Society, the first one was in 1902 in London, and the second one was in 1903 in Washington. The interesting thing about the Pilgrim Society today, I mean, everybody that is involved in foreign policy on the Anglo-American establishment, so people from, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations in the US, certainly the US State Department, and people in from the British and now European foreign policy, you know, the Foreign Office and things like that, will attend the Pilgrim Society. A US ambassador's first duty when they are first appointed, their first formal engagement in the UK is with the Pilgrim Society. They'll go to the Pilgrim Society dinner. So it's given all the pomp and circumstance and, you know, it's kind of people sort of, you know, oh, it's just an evening out. It's just a nice evening, an opportunity for the ambassador to shake hands and get to meet people in the country. And the same goes for the British ambassador in the United States. Their first formal civic engagement is the dinner at the Pilgrim Society. And it's given the same kind of ceremonial pat on the back kind of air. However, in effect, what that means is their first duty is to hear what the Pilgrim Society have to say. And the Pilgrim Society are the core of the Anglo-American establishment. And they want to hear what the ambassador, more to the point, they want to tell the ambassador, what they think. So, I mean, the people that have been involved in it over the years, I mean, if you think of the great and good of the political establishment, you know, Kissinger, the Rockefellers, not that they're political, but if, you know, or the people that have got this kind of, who Rothkopf said were the people that could move millions of people across borders. Those are the people who attend the Pilgrim Society. So Margaret Thatcher, you know, every president, nearly every, Churchill, people like that. That's what the Pilgrim Society does.
So it's a sort of almost like a shadow government, really. I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
Yes.
Sounds like. But anyway, look, this New World Order, you know, why is it new? It's not new, is it, really?
No, I think that's a good question, actually. And I think it's constantly reiterating. I mean, if you look at the hopes initially of, you know, certainly when Quigley started looking into the Round Table movement, which is what Milner, you know, first set up the Milner's Kindergarten in South Africa, which were a group of young rebel, not rebel lawyers, but they were certainly ambitious young lawyers and administrators, and quite ruthless as well. We're talking about, you know, the establishing the basis for the Boer War and so forth. They set up the Round Table movement, which is a system of a global system of, as you sort of said, a kind of shadow government. But one of the first things that they wanted to do was, one of their first plans was to create something which they called the, I can't remember the name of it now, it was a tripartite world. So this was during the 1920s. By the time we get to the sort of 1920s and 1930s, they envisaged a world which was led by the US, British, Anglo-American establishment, a Europe dominated by a Nazi Germany, and a Eurasia, kind of East Eurasia, dominated by the Soviet Union. That was their model. That was what they were going for. Now, clearly, history shows that didn't pan out in the end. So they're not infallible. It's not like the New World Order is set in stone and this is what will happen. It's an ambition. So it's new. It's constantly new, if you think about it in that sense, because it adapts and it there are new iterations of it as it adapts to circumstances. But what that also tells us is that these people, and I mean, and one of the things that really annoys me about when we talk about the people who are, certainly when critics, particularly when they talk about the people that are behind this movement, is that we tend to refer to them as elite. Well, what does that mean? Elite suggests that they are special in some way, or they're particularly gifted, perhaps, or they're, you know, that they're omnipotent even. And they're not. Their plans have consistently failed, actually. They've tried to implement things. They've had a tremendous impact on the world, and millions of lives have been lost thanks to their shenanigans. But they're certainly not omnipotent, and they're certainly fallible, because they persist, they consistently do not achieve what they intend to achieve. But they keep trying, and they are single-minded, and they're intent on doing it.
Well, one way I put it to you that they are elite is they don't seem to be, well, they seem to be above the law. You know, they seem to pull the strings of justice to make sure that certainly nobody's going to come and feel their collars, however bad the and crooked and criminal the things that they do are. You know, but then there's also the role of the big foundations in all of this more recently over the last 150 years or so, because some of these individual powerful families like the Rockefellers, for example, have realized that the way to actually get more wealth is to make sure it's not taxed and set up a foundation of some sort. Yeah. Yeah. So can you say something about their role? Because they are supposed to be effectively charities, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, the tax-free philanthropic foundation, if you could go back to the sort of, I think the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which was established in 1910, kind of was the forerunner for that model. They realised that by, you know, and obviously the Carnegie family, incredibly powerful industrialists in the US, they realised that they could use their wealth to shape policy and also use it to shape society. So, I mean, they were engaged in what we would call social engineering projects. So one of the things that the Carnegie Endowment were particularly interested in were the life sciences, science and education. And so by investing in, by giving them, I mean, it's a difficult thing to say, because there is some element of genuine philanthropy there. You know, that if you look at our economic development, we have benefited greatly from the economic development that's happened over the 20th century and into the early part of the 21st century. And a big part of that has come with some assistance from the philanthropic foundations. However, that's not the reason why they do it. They do it because they create the environment and the socioeconomic environment that they wish to benefit from. So, I mean, if we now, talking about the pseudo-pandemic that we've got at the moment, if we think about the Gates Foundation, the Gates Foundation is invested in vaccines, and the Gates Foundation is ostensibly doing philanthropic acts. And we keep constantly hearing about how much money the Gates Foundation have given away. But at the same time, the Gates Foundation Trust, which is the profit-making, money-making arm of the Gates Foundation, you know, their wealth, certainly Bill Gates' wealth, has doubled in the last 10 years. We can't give money away and have, you know, you can't go from a net worth of $50 billion to over $110 billion in less than a decade by giving your money away. Because the things that the foundations invest in, although they may have a beneficial, there may be some benefit to society, to wider society, from the things that they invest in, they benefit from it more. And if they didn't benefit from it more, they wouldn't do it. So that's how the tax foundation works. And as you quite rightly put, they are tax free. So it's also, if you're somebody like Bill Gates, who has potentially would have a tax bill of billions and billions of pounds or dollars, by having a tax-free foundation, he can siphon off that money into the foundation, get a pat on the back from the global media, which he also funds through his foundation, and then, you know, everyone thinks he's a jolly nice chap, and he doesn't have to pay any tax. So even from a really rudimentary, basic economic perspective, the foundations are in these people's interests. But they use them for much more than just financial manipulation. They use them for social engineering, which is exactly what we are seeing at the moment with, you know, this plandemic.
Yeah, well, one of the things that they use this money for is funding thousands and thousands of chairs at various universities. So they have an enormous amount of influence over whole academic areas. So, say, for example, history, you know, these sorts of things. You'll have loads and loads and loads of these foundation-funded history chairs, you know, particularly in medicine, for example, is another one, where you get lots of these people. So they have their kind of a stable of professors, you know, or professional people who basically go along with their views. And, you know, it's I'm afraid it's human nature. Where you see money, and if you say, well, if I say X, Y, and Z, you know, and I then I'm going to have a job for life and be paid loads of money, be given a professorship, etc. People are just going to do that because people do follow the money, particularly in the modern world, which is becoming less and less, people are getting less and less able to find a stable profession, having been booted out of many of them. But anyway, so yeah, I don't know if you've really answered my question about how this isn't very new. I mean, I know you said it changes, and they're trying over the centuries to do this. Can you point to any particular events, and maybe world wars and things like that, where you can see the hidden hand of a new world order of some sort?
Yeah, I mean, the world wars, that would be good. You know, I mean, so if you look at the Second World War, you know, the model of the quote we could call the New World Order is to fund all sides of all wars. So they are financially funding all combatants, because whoever the winner is, they win. I mean, that's basically the model. So, I mean, if we look at the Second World War, in the lead up to the Second World War, you know, as Hitler was coming to power. I mean, one thing that has kind of amuses me when you talk about history and you're saying about how the foundations control history is, if you look at the story, the official story of Hitler's economic miracle, I mean, that, you know, the story is that Germany went from literally you couldn't buy a loaf of bread. You had to take a wheelbarrow full of cash to the shop to buy a loaf of bread. This was a crippled, and that too came from, you know, from the Treaty of Versailles, which was a really stupidly, you know, tried to destroy the German economy. You go from this totally crippled, absolutely annihilated economy, which literally where people are starving, to within the space of about 4 or 5 years, building Europe's first national motorway system and remilitarizing, building the biggest army and biggest military force in Europe. Well, how does a broke a broke nation with whose industrial base has been given away to other countries, how do they do that? Well, they do it with funding from the West, where from Wall Street is how they do it. So it was the international banks in London, in the city, and in Wall Street were financing the rebuilding and restructuring of Germany. Well, why? You know, that at the same time they were saying that after the Treaty of Versailles, they were saying that Germany was some sort of threat, and yet they're constantly building it up. And we see the same now with China. We see exactly the same with China. We are being given the impression that China are some sort of, you know, that they're the menace, or that, you know, or the comic, you know, the Wuhan flu, like China invented it. I mean, I'm not talking about the gain of function stuff and all that. There may be something in that. Who knows? But China are not an enemy. China have never invaded us. They don't present any threat to the West. They've never threatened the West in any military way. Economically, maybe, but not in a military way. China's economic miracle, where they have allegedly lifted 850 million people out of poverty, they've certainly made huge economic strides. But how has that happened? Well, it's been with foreign direct investment from the West. It's been with foreign direct investment into their infrastructure, into the development of their industries, into the development of their technology. I mean, this is all happening with Western development money. Why? Because in order for the New World Order, whatever that, you know, you want to call it, in order for them to be able to continue with their project, we need to have an enemy, so that we are distracted and constantly focusing on a distorted view of reality, to be honest. I mean, we are given a narrative to believe in, which is just complete garbage. I mean, it's just nonsensical drivel, really. I mean, we need to be focusing on the real problem, which is not, you know, the China are baddies and we're goodies, or Russia are baddies and we're the goodies. I mean, this is childish view of the world. That's not the way it works. It works through international finance and the manipulation of markets. And that is what is happening. And that is not being done by one country. That is being done by international financiers. And they are the people that are playing the game, while the rest of us are just doing something else.
Well, look, the big question is, where are we heading with this, do you think?
Well, I mean, we are heading for, at the moment, unless we get our heads out of our arses, we are heading for a global technocracy ruled by a scientific technocratic elite and I've said the word elite now, but they but they will be. You know, if we're not careful, that's what they will be in all you know, in any way that you could judge it. We're heading for a system where democratic accountability is meaningless. I mean, I would argue that democratic accountability is meaningless now anyway, but that's another point. But we are heading to a system of top-down control where we will be told what we need to do. We will have a behavioural commitment that we need to make for our biosecurity, which Giorgio Agamben has warned us about. The biosecurity state will be the basic control mechanism, and on top, and that will enable the construction of a global technocratic system of governance. So the people who will be in charge will be the scientists at the World Health Organization, or the economists at the IMF and the World Bank. These would be the people who we will look to as being in charge. Well, the problem with that is nobody elects them, nobody can remove them from power, and, you know, they really are just doing what they're told anyway.
Well, that's right. Yeah, they're puppets, effectively. These people are pliable stooges. They've got no real thoughts for their own. I mean, look at the boss of the World Health Organization. He's got no medical qualifications. He's, you know, he's just in there because he's someone who has been proved, you know, on a national level to do what he's told and say what he's told to say. So effectively, you've got a stage managed pantomime. But so anyway, should we try and get behind the veil then? Who is giving these people their orders?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say, isn't it? There are so many layers of obfuscation that it's difficult to know who is actually pulling the strings. But there are certain families, you know, you've got the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers and so forth. I mean, you could look at it from the terms of the black nobility, you know, then you'd be looking back at the Venetian family. So it'd be people like the Guelphs, and which are obviously our royal family, are aligned with, you know, Orsinis, people like that. I mean, there's this historical argument that these people in charge. But I mean, the more I look at it, the more I tend to think that the inner core. Quigley revealed that the Rhodes group, the All Souls crowd, the Chatham House crowd, they operated a system of rings within rings within rings. It was compartmentalized authoritarianism. And at the centre of that was the Society of the Elect. So if we're saying, who are the Society of the Elect? Who are they? So as I've just said, you know, you might start thinking about families like the Orsinis and the Guelphs and things like that. But I personally believe, I don't know, so this is pure speculation on my part, that it evolves in the same way that all kind of business hierarchies evolve. So I think people perhaps go into it and come out of it. And I think it depends on and I think that there is political and economic stressors within that group. I mean, I think we've seen something of that bubbling to the surface in recent years with the rise of the kind of popularist right wing kind of Trumpian worldview. And then the more kind of progressive, I would say European, kind of Fabian society kind of worldview. And I think there are obvious tensions there. And I don't know, but I would imagine that those tensions also play out at the level of the Society of the Elect. You know, so I think the people who are in charge certainly are not the people that we're given on our television screens. So I don't think for one minute that Bill Gates is in charge. I think he's influential and I think he's a very powerful person. Nor do I think Klaus Schwab is in charge.
I mean, the question has to be who put Gates in power and originally, really, because he was a nobody who was given this amazing CIA task, which was basically to build a computer operating system which the intelligence services could use to sneak into everybody's computers in the future. And he built his empire based on that. And then he realized, well, I own all the shares in, or a lot of shares in Microsoft, so I don't really need to be on the board. This is, I mean, I find this fascinating, and people don't understand. Just because Bill Gates is not on the board of Microsoft, it doesn't mean to say he doesn't have an influence. He decides who is going to be on the board because of his share, through his shareholding nominations. But then he goes on to the pharmaceutical industry and somewhere else. I guess
it's farming.
Yeah, well, that's right. And farming, very important. And seed banks and this sort of thing. The idea of monopolizing the world's food supply. And this is all something which I think it was the writer David Livingstone that I saw first pointing out that Gates is really just the modern day Rockefeller. You know, what Rockefeller was doing in banking and oil, Gates is doing in IT and now you said as well farming, but obviously the pharmaceuticals.
Yeah. There's also the same thing. I mean, there's the whole kind of the Rockefeller, the March of Dimes thing, the whole kind of not the March of Dimes, you know, the Rockefeller giving away the silver dime, his transformation, you know, which Edward Bernays helped him transform into this, because he was despised, wasn't he? He was an utterly despised figure. And then he was transformed by manipulating the media into this sort of kindly old grandfather type figure that was giving away dimes to the needy. Well, Gates has done exactly the same thing. Gates was despised for his ruthless business practices and his destruction of his opponents when, you know, in the early days of kind of the big tech bubble. And he and people hated him for the fact that he took essentially open source software and commercialized it and privatized it and put intellectual property on it. So he wasn't a popular guy at all. But then gradually, how much money does he give the BBC? Was it 53 million or something he's given them in the last 2 or 3 years? He's funded a global PR campaign to transform him from basically a hated nerd into some sort of, wonderful, all-giving, lovely vaccine hero. I mean, and at the same time has massively increased his own personal net wealth, which is brilliant when you think about it.
Okay. Final point though is, look, let's look at Adolf Hitler. You were talking a bit about what brought him to power, which was creating a terrible economic situation, really harsh conditions for all Germans, or certainly anyone that didn't have massive savings and hadn't managed to keep those savings, because of course the hyperinflation eroded millions of people's savings in those days. So those who were on the inside managed to ride it out, but the vast majority of the Germans in the 20s were having a terrible time. I mean, we are now getting into a situation, particularly with the pandemic, that millions of people have lost their businesses. That the big corporations, the big investment banks, the hedge funds have been able to buy these assets up for peanuts, also, extend their monopolies or oligopolies. The big businesses have extended into the markets that, small players have now been booted out of as well. There's also, of course, through this diabolical, treacherous media, an absolute dearth in culture. You know, so we've got some terrible programs, really diabolical stuff that most sensible people just don't bother watching any of it. So we've got an economic and cultural dearth, which of course is the perfect red carpet for the next dictator to I would imagine somebody far less ranty than Hitler and someone with a kind of smooth tongue. So that's, I wonder what you make of that idea. That,
well, someone like Keir Starmer.
Oh well, I think not. But I mean, to have a leader who's actually quite convincing now to sort of sort things out, and as the elite and the usual suspects sort these things out, then that person then gets the credibility for getting things back to normal again and having some decent economy and decent culture.
There's certainly a possibility. If you look, talk about history repeating itself, then the same economic conditions that were being built in Germany in the 1930s are exactly the same as what's being built currently in most Western democratic societies, including, more importantly, including the US. So I don't think this leader, whoever this leader might be, is going to be a national leader. I think they are now certainly thinking in terms of the global level. We're talking about global governance, and I think the leader that may emerge at, I mean, something that always interested me, and I remember somebody talking about a long time ago, and because I, in answer to your question, Tony, I have no idea who this person might be. But someone mentioned to me a long time ago that Prince William, could Prince William be the great person to bring everybody's confidence back? I mean, who knows? But I mean, I think I don't see what you see, to be honest. I don't see this turning round and us getting back to some sort of economic stability. That economic stability will come at the price of immense oppression.
So, yeah, it just seems to me that, you know, we're going to be forced to, but you know, things are going to get so bad that, you know, any cage will seem to be better than the situation where we were. And you know, this is, I think, you know, is the way that these elites operate, is they like to think that they steer our destiny. And you know, they've had centuries and centuries of sitting on their backsides, really, you know, because they've had so much money they didn't know what to do with it, and lots of time to plot and plan.
I mean, I would say this is the culmination of centuries of planning. This is the game for all the marbles. All the things that perhaps people, you know, that have been looking at this kind of information have been talking about for a long time. I mean, there's so much. If you're talking about, say, the potential for depopulation, I mean, that is something that we do have to look at. I think we have to look that square in the face. Because if you look at carbon neutral policies, you look at the future of healthcare, public healthcare, the way that everything is being constructed, you have to say, is predicated upon a much smaller population. I mean, that's just, I mean, if you look at the idea for a carbon neutral, take something really simple like the cars, that we're going to get rid of cars by 2050 or whatever. So the idea is that we're going to move over to these electric vehicles, right? Well, there isn't enough natural resource. With current battery technology, unless there is some sort of quantum advance in battery technology, there is not enough resources. There's not enough copper. There's not enough lithium. There's not enough. There aren't enough natural resources on Earth to possibly run a transport infrastructure like we've got at the moment, as an electric network. There just isn't. So that policy appears to be predicated upon the idea that there will be a lot less vehicles. And I'm not just talking about cars and trucks and buses. I'm talking about a lot less vehicles, full stop. Well, does that mean that they're envisaging us all living at home and never going anywhere ever again, like we're going to be in some sort of permanent lockdown? Or do they, as I suspect, see that it's based on a lot smaller population?
Well, interesting. Can you just remind listeners whereabouts they can find your blog and maybe say, tell us something about the latest, your thoughts on their latest post?
Yeah, well, I've been writing more lately for the UK column. A lot of my posts are posted there. My blog is In This Together, which is in-this-together.com. I've been also my second book is due to come out very shortly. So I've been working on that, and my last post on In This Together was quite some time ago. But I've been writing quite regularly for UK Column, so you can certainly catch up, and that's ukcolumn.org.
So what was your last article for them about?
My last article for them was about a company called Omnicom and Omnigov, which I think it was called Buying a Single Version of the Truth. Omnigov basically have got they're a subsidiary of an American corporation called Omnicom, and the British government have given them something over the last 2 years, contracts which amount to £1.6 billion for propaganda. So when we've been propagandized over the during the pandemic, Omnigov, who are, as I said, a subsidiary of Omnicom, have been giving us that propaganda. They've got the media buy-in contract for and this is something else which is remarkable. And when you think about it, if we're supposed to live in a free market economy, Omnicom are the sole supplier for the entire British government in terms of their media strategy. They've got the whole thing, they're entirely sewn up.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually pretty sinister stuff from a journalist's point of view.
Yeah.
You've got expert behavioural psychologists who are governing the public relations spin the government are putting on events. You know, because this is quite incredible. What these people basically do, and there's a whole rather dark art of this, is what they do is they press people's unconscious buttons. So they know what people are afraid of at a very kind of subconscious level. And they're now doing advertising which hits people at that level in order to get them to basically do a kind of knee-jerk response. And that's exactly what's happened. And, of course, you know, well, I don't know how much you know, but, you know, I was booted off the FM airwaves by a station manager in Bristol on this community radio station, a guy called Pat Hart, who just so happens to be a long-term friend of the Blairite mayor, Marvin Rees, in the run-up to the election. He doesn't want a politics program criticizing his chum. That was all done under this excuse of, oh, well, Ofcom have got these guidelines and we don't want you saying anything that might contradict the government plan to, you know, take people out of hospitals, put them in care homes and kill thousands of people.
Mm.
So, you know, we were there and we were there as a critical friend, if you want, of public money and governance, and we were booted out too. But anyway, I'll leave the final word to you, and I just wonder if, you know, what you make of the general media scene in the country today. As I'll leave that to you, Ian, as a final kind of scene, and because we need a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel too.
I think that one of the most encouraging things that has been the emergence of what I would call a real news media. I think the danger that we've got is that the powers that be or shouldn't be are also aware of it. So with the rise of citizen journalists, with the rise of what people call the alternative media, which I would say is the news media, because they're the people that are actually reporting facts, that are providing people with evidence that they can verify, that they can check for themselves and make up their own minds. And the best amongst that bunch constantly advocate that their readers, listeners and viewers do exactly that, that they think for themselves and that they don't take what they're told on trust. Now, I think you said something earlier when you're talking about the dearth of culture. One of the most important aspects of that has been the death, the absolute death of mainstream journalism. You just said that, and you're one of many, many, many examples of good quality journalists that have either been told to shut up or kicked out of their positions or made redundant for doing that thing which journalists must do, that vital part of society, that function in society which they serve, which is to question power. If when journalism stops questioning power, we are in deep, deep trouble. And that is exactly what has happened. Certainly, we've seen it in extremists during this pandemic. I mean, the mainstream media have been an utter disgrace. I mean, when you've got a situation where some of the world's leading scientists, the most eminent scientists in the world, are being called in the media as cranks and conspiracy theorists because they are questioning the government's policy, then the mainstream media is a dinosaur media, and it doesn't serve any kind of useful purpose whatsoever.
Well, at least there's still a few of us going. Ian Davis, thanks very much for joining us from the blog InThisTogether.com and UK column. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. Cheers, Tony.